disaster. Don't you give up, don't you let away. Talking about a forever after. Don't you give up, don't you dare give in.
Yes, don't you give up, don't you dare give in. And it is indeed most precarious out there. Hi, this is Jack Tuckner and Deborah Orell, the Women's Rights in the Workplace Advocates, joining you today. And hope you're having a terrific beginning of the week. We have a great, great show for you today, despite how precarious it is out there, because over here in Women's Rights in the Workplace Advocates, we don't dare give in, and we don't expect you to either. How are you today, Deborah Orell? Well, that's good to hear. Are you excited about our guest?
Really excited.
We have for you, listeners, Assemblyman Daniel O'Donnell from the New York Assembly, an outstanding legislator. I mean, a good guy, a man whose sole purpose is to help New Yorkers, not to obstruct New Yorkers' success and peace and willing and ability to live the life that we choose to live without fear of hydrofracking and bullying and inequality. And we'll talk with Assemblyman O'Donnell in just a few minutes about all of that. But why don't we start out the show, Deb, just talking a little bit about some labor and employment news of the week. And most of it happens to dovetail very nicely with the work of Assemblyman O'Donnell, and I'm sure he'll be speaking about some of these issues, such as, for instance, just this week, the Obama administration indicated that it would not author an executive order to bar discrimination in the workplace for the LGBT community, because its spokesman, Jay Carney, indicated that such an executive order would be redundant because ENDA, the anti-discrimination law that still hasn't passed, would make such discrimination in the workplace illegal. Finally, I mean, for those who don't know, right now, under federal law, there is still no law that bars discrimination on the basis of sexual orientation or perceived sexual orientation. And the law, which passed in the Senate, but is still pending and likely doomed before the current House of Representatives, would only apply when it finally is passed to those who work for employers with at least 15 employees. So it would be very important, certainly, to have President Obama not be wishy-washy on this issue and to sort of walk the talk and to say, you know what, there's millions of federal contractors, millions of employees that work for federal contractors that would be protected by this law. So it is not redundant. You know, redundancy, as we were just discussing before the show started, is often the term Republicans use to say, you know what, we don't really need that. We don't need a state law. There's already a federal law because we don't really believe in that law. And that's obviously what the Obama administration is saying. Really, it's disappointing because the executive orders that exist for race and for sex that are very important that we have, despite the fact that we also have laws. The Civil Rights Act of 1964 protects people on the basis of race and color and gender from being discriminated against. But we also have an executive order because it comes from the top. You know, as they say, the fish smells or rots from the head down. From the top, the president says, as he said recently about the minimum wage, and it's helped a lot of people.
Right.
This has come. I can control this, and I'm saying this is not right. And still, he won't. He's pulling punches when it comes to.
And it's really disappointing.
Right. So.
But on the other hand, he is signing two executive orders.
That's right. He is signing two executive orders, what, tomorrow?
Yes.
April 8th, which
yes.
is also, what's tomorrow, Deb?
Equal pay day.
Equal pay day. And President Obama is signing, he's set to sign an executive order barring federal contractors from retaliating against employees who talk about their salaries with each other. You know, in the wake of last June was the 50th anniversary of the Equal Pay Act. And even then, when the Equal Pay Act was revisited, I think Lyndon Johnson signed that into law 50 years mm-hmm. ago. When it was revisited, it was still noted that there is a significant gender pay gap still.
Still.
And it's most prominent for women when a woman enters her childbearing years. And because Congress won't raise wages and won't address gender pay disparities more than it already has done, and there are a lot of problems and loopholes with the Equal Pay Act itself, President Obama is imposing his policies directly on federal contractors. And this is, you know what, this is a long tradition that presidents follow, exerting their power you know, on a fraction of the economy that's directly under their control, like federal contractors. So this comes about at a great time.
Which is 25% of the workforce.
Is what?
Federal contractors. People working
for the... A lot of people.
Yeah.
Exactly. So it's not insignificant.
Well, and what it does is it establishes a law, a precedent, a way of doing business that over a period of time people see, okay, so this is not as... You know, this is not something to be so afraid of, that we can do this.
Exactly. Oh, I neglected to mention at the beginning our phone number for our listeners that want to call in with any questions, thoughts about what we're talking about, or a direct question for Assemblyman O'Donnell. We'll be on in a few moments. The call-in number is area code 888-874-4888. Again, area code 888-874-4888. Listen on your phone, not on your radio or desktop. So, you know, and this comes at a time when I believe the president is queuing up for the Democrats. You know, there's going to be an upcoming vote on the Paycheck Fairness Act, mm-hmm. which will go much further to level the playing field for working women than the Equal Pay Act did, because it requires the Department of Labor to work with employers to eliminate pay disparities and not just leave it up to the individual woman to make sure she's being paid what she's worth. So that's quite important. What else is going on in the news? Oh, and by the way, this has been 5 years since the Lilly Ledbetter Act, when President Obama's first legislative act was to sign into law the Lilly Ledbetter Act. We won't have time today to talk about it. We may have mentioned in the past, we may do a whole show on that, but Lilly Ledbetter, you know, sort of the Rosa Parks of, if you will, equal pay and gender pay fairness, an icon who spent decades suffering under extremely unequal pay and sexual harassment in her workplace, won her case, and ultimately never received 10 cents, even though she won millions of dollars.
Because
the Supreme Court of the United States and the lower courts beneath it reversed, saying she didn't really follow the statute, which required her to complain about her unequal pay within 180 days of finding out that she wasn't paid fairly, equally, the same as men. Unfortunately, she didn't find out. She couldn't find out.
Which
and that's is, what this what executive order addresses.
Exactly. That's why this one is so important. And tomorrow, the recognition of the Equal Pay Day, why that's important and why it is in April, is that it takes women 15 months to earn what men earn in 12 months. So that's why they make it in April, and I think it's like the first something. It's been a couple of years now. So tomorrow, I imagine that there are a lot of events going on all over the place, but tomorrow in Manhattan, there's a press conference. There's at noon tomorrow, City Hall, demonstrations, protesting, and for women to wear red tomorrow. Red because we're mad as hell. Red because our checkbooks are in the red based on, you know, how we're paid. So, and that's why I think he's signing these particular executive orders tomorrow in recognition and having her there, because had she, which is why it's so important for employers to make available. How do you know you're being underpaid unless somebody talks about it? When, you know, I've worked in places where you talk about it and you get yelled at.
Where you're
allowed
to talk about it. Or where they post what the salaries are.
Right.
Right.
So that's important.
Also this week, and before Congressman O'Donnell calls in, I wanted to just mention a couple of things. Walmart, and I believe it was announced this week, although it was several weeks ago, that they changed their policies. Finally, the country's largest, thank you, the country's largest employer now has changed their pregnancy policy to finally allow for a woman who's experiencing pregnancy-related challenges and needs some measure of lighter work or needs a stool to sit on or can't do everything.
Well, in Walmart's case, they were talking about having women climb ladders with heavy boxes while they're pregnant.
Exactly. And then make them take maternity leave 6 months before the baby
and,
is born.
And the woman who became the poster child was actually, she was willing to take the cashier job, which pays even less. And they kind of made her the poster person of it. But the way they rewrote their rule, they still have an out.
Well, we should give them a little credit where it's due, that they have helped a number of women. And hopefully that will start a certain amount of dominoes falling in that area. We have on the line New York State Assemblyman Daniel O'Donnell. I just want to tell our listeners something about the great assemblyman representing New York's 69th District in Manhattan. But, of course, he really represents all New Yorkers because Assemblyman O'Donnell was the prime mover in the enactment of New York's marriage equality law signed by Governor Cuomo on June 24, 2011. And I think it's really his signature accomplishment. Should be named after him. Should be called, O'Donnell Care or something a lot more clever because he's the first openly gay man elected to the New York Assembly in New York. Introduced this basic civil rights legislation, I believe, four times before the New York Senate Republicans finally deigned to allow the gay and lesbian community to enjoy legal equality in matters of love and affectional preference. Assemblyman O'Donnell is the, in addition to marriage equality, which again is a huge legacy for him to have and to have left for all of us, he's the proud sponsor or the co-sponsor of 7 bills to combat the substantial risks of hydrofracking in the state of New York. And just last May, the New York State Assembly's Environmental Conservation Committee passed Assemblyman O'Donnell's vital bill to prohibit the use of the toxic, dangerous hydrofracking flowback brine water, how attractive, on our roads and highways.
Say that three times fast.
Well, I can't. If you want to watch this, he made mincemeat out of Karen Moreau, the executive director of the New York State Petroleum Council, in an extremely enjoyable January 13th, 2013 interrogation before the Environmental Committee. A couple of great lines in there. You can find it easily on YouTube. He's a tireless advocate for our children. He's a member of the Education Committee. One of Assemblyman O'Donnell's top priorities in office is to ensure that all children have the resources they need to be successful. Just last month, Assemblyman O'Donnell delivered 2,400 books donated by his constituents to be distributed to under-resourced New York City public schools, as well as homeless shelters, community centers, juvenile detention facilities, and pre- and after-school programs. And speaking of our kids, Deborah, in the wake of the horrific Newtown, Connecticut massacre, Daniel voted for New York's crucial and sensible gun safety legislation known as the SAFE Act, which will result in much better protection from gun violence for vulnerable New Yorkers. Finally, as of July, and not least, but last in my intro, as of July 1st, 2012, all of New York State students have been protected by O'Donnell's Dignity for All Students Act, a seminal, leading, comprehensive anti-bullying law. It's outstanding. Whose prime sponsor was Daniel O'Donnell, who collaborated with the Dignity Task Force to develop guidelines that are consistent with the legislative intent of this law, which is that schools foster an inclusive culture rather than just focusing on punishing bullies or worse, allowing what most of us have gone through in our lifetimes, completely unaddressed issues of, you know, bullying middle school children that result in lots of suffering, depression, and even suicide.
Right.
Assemblyman O'Donnell, welcome to the program. Thank you for coming on.
Jack, I should have you follow me around more often. I'll tell you that. Days I forget. Now, you left out the most important part.
Please.
Colleagues at law school.
Well, that's right. I guess that was. I thought I might be giving away too much to say it's almost 30 years ago that we started law school together at
that's
the
correct.
University
yeah.
of New York. It do go fast, does it not?
It did.
So,
but it's interesting, law in the service of human needs,
that's
and
right.
look at the area both of you have gone into.
Right. Well,
the graduates of CUNY Law School have done exemplary work in fighting for change and justice, and I'm happy to do my part.
And that you are doing.
And we're happy you do it, too.
And we're happy as well. So can you tell us then, can we start with the Dignity for Students Act? Can you tell us a little bit about how that came about, your interest, what motivated it, and what so far, how that law has made some big difference to our students?
Well, when I ran for office in 2002, I certainly supported it. It was an existing bill that Steve Sanders, who was then the chair of the Education Committee, had here in Albany. And when I got here, I decided that since I come from a loudmouth family, I should be quiet and try to observe and figure things out. So literally for the first 4 or 5 months I was here, I didn't say anything. And sure enough, the Dignity for All Students bill came out on the floor, and one of my colleagues from the Republican side made a horrible homophobic statement on the floor of the Assembly, and I kind of lost it. And the New York Post wrote, O'Donnell throws fit on floor, okay?
Mm-hmm.
So I sort of lost it in the moment about what was being said around this particular subject. And then when Mr. Sanders retired, I was somewhat the obvious person to carry the bill.
Mm-hmm.
The bill, when it was enacted, was the most comprehensive anti-bullying bill in the country. And what it did was it required schools to be knowledgeable about bullying. It requires schools to keep track and to report to state ed the incidents of bullying. It requires them, teachers, to be trained on these subjects.
Mm-hmm.
And it requires that there be curriculum in the schools. Now, there's model curriculum that the Dignity Task Force came up with. Schools can follow that, but they don't have to follow it. What I learned in this process was that across the state, there are great variances. Some schools had little or no curriculum or little no instruction about it, and some were actually fairly on top of the subject.
Mm-hmm.
And what I learned through this process, when the bill was originally passed and then was written, regulations were written, that we had some very unusual allies. The school bus drivers turned out to be incredibly helpful allies. And the reason was because, A, when you say bullying in schools, you often think, you know, when the school bell rings. But the truth is, for some of our students, mm-hmm. they're in a bus for an hour
right.
before they get to the school. Mm-hmm. And bus drivers, you know, need guidance on what to do. When the bill was signed into law, it was the first time that gender identity and expression was ever written into New York law.
And that was the first time in that
first
bill.
Time. That was the first time that ever that was written. And I knew when Steve left that that was what the barrier was to the state Senate. If I was willing to, you know, throw that community under the bus, we could get it passed right away. And so I knew that I needed to hold on to that bill to make sure that that wasn't watered down, because it is those children who break gender stereotypes and gender norms that are often the first targets mm-hmm. of bullying.
Right.
And so it was a great victory. When the Senate passed it almost unanimously, I think there was only 4 no votes. It makes you wonder what took them so long if they only have 4 no votes.
Right.
But it took a long time. I mean, this
right.
bill was pending for over a decade. And so what then happened was, because, you know, the world has changed, cyberbullying, which didn't exist when I was a kid. I mean, there was no cyber
right,
anything,
right?
So, and that became a very difficult expansion to do because of some court cases that had to do with whether or not schools were permitted to discipline kids for conduct off of school grounds.
Mm-hmm.
And so the civil liberties crowd and I had to work really hard to make the language work as best we could to establish that, in fact, if it interferes with the school, with the school's the kids' education in school, then it is something that the school can take action on. And so,
would that interference be, you know, a child's depression?
Yes.
Yeah.
I mean, the truth was, we wrote it and we went along with it, and it was the right thing to do. But I always felt that you didn't need to specifically lay that out, because if it carried over into the school, then Dignity already covered it. But we wanted to make it more explicit so they would understand that they have an obligation to do something about this.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, for example, they would often talk about the kid who was so traumatized by what was on the World Wide Web that they would just go into the nurse's office and sit there all day. Well, guess what? That already covers Dignity, because that's interfering with the ability of that child to get the mm-hmm. education. And in the end, the goal was to create a school culture where bullying and harassment are not tolerated. And we had some great, in getting this done, the kids of the state of New York stepped up, I have to tell you. But they came here and they went and they saw their state senators and they explained to them what happened in their school and what happened to their friends. And it really was, you know, a holistic movement of the people who were being impacted saying, you have to do more. So we're currently looking at how well that's working to see whether or not additions or changes can be made. Nothing's ever perfect, but it was a very big advance, particularly for protection of gender identity and expression.
Excellent. And how do we get, you know, how does one get the message out to the students and the parents of individual schools? How, you know, does the average kid in a middle school in the inner city know about this law?
You know, it's hard for me to answer that other than to say the law requires that their curriculum be adjusted to include it.
Okay.
So they have to be taught it in the schools every year. So there has to be a way to talk about differences. When I get invited to schools, which, to be quite frank, is the best part of my job. I get invited to schools all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And with little kids, I try to bring up this subject. And I say, what color is my hair? Because I figure, you know, hair color is something easy for them to identify. And they say, your hair is white. I'm like, all right, that was not the answer I was looking for. But the truth is that there's a way at every age level to introduce the idea that kids, that people are different. We're not the same size. We're not the same height. Our skin color is different tones. Our hair color is different tones. You know, all those different things that are the reasons kids get bullied. You have to begin early on making sure that acceptance is part of what is integrated into the school curriculum.
Right. Well,
and that's what the bill requires. And, you know, will it work in all cases? No, but we're hoping that it will move in the right direction.
And are there educational materials that are provided to the schools? I'm just trying to think if you're trying to sort of sensitize, and whether it's gender identity or sexual orientation issues or just the kid with terrible acne who's having the worst year of his life, right? It all comes down to really the same issues that many of us either were or know someone who was sort of tormented out of an educational environment or worse. You know, so these things, they're all sort of considered equal in terms of bullying is bullying, and it's disallowed, and we have zero tolerance toward that type of...
Well, we don't say zero tolerance. Part of the problem is, to answer your first question, yes, there are booklets and there are training materials. Mm-hmm. Schools have to have someone on site who is well-versed in all of this.
Okay.
What we've learned, which I wouldn't have known, there's, you know, an expert in everything. There's an expert at Syracuse University. She has a PhD in bullying, and that's what
really?
She knows.
Okay.
Okay?
Yeah.
And what we know from her work is that, in fact, you know, punishment is often the wrong thing to do. So, you know, suspending a kid who was bullied,
mm-hmm.
who was bullying, may not be the best course to make the conduct stop.
Right.
And oftentimes, the kid who is bullying in school is being
bullied at home.
Right.
And so, you know, during the last debate with the, which we had around the cyberbullying part, mm-hmm. we do not mandate that the principal notify the parent. And one of my colleagues who I was very close friends with stood up and said, why did you not put that in there? And I said, well, because if the kid is getting bullied because he told his best friend he's gay, and he hasn't told his parents that he's gay, for the principal to call home and say, your son's being bullied because he's gay, may not be helping the situation.
Exactly.
And I said, he said, well, I would want to know. And I said, yes, Mr. Jordan, I'm sure you would, and I'm sure your principal would call you. But I'm not writing a law that says a principal has to do X. A principal has to know about bullying. A principal has to be aware of the impacts of bullying. But I'm not going to tell them that they have to resolve it one way or the other.
Mm-hmm.
The key is to create an environment in a school culture that doesn't let it go on.
Mm-hmm. What would for a listener who happens to say, you know what, my son or my nephew or my niece or my daughter is going through this right now, and they don't know and they haven't heard about this, who should they contact?
They should be able to contact their local school district.
Okay.
Certainly if they can't get any assistance, they can contact me, and I will tell them, you know, who they can get in contact with. I mean, we now have a lot of experience with a lot of different school districts on how they're dealing with this individual problem. Now, one thing that I need to clarify, this does not include private or parochial schools.
Okay.
And I've had a constituent who come in to complain that her kid was being bullied at a parochial school.
Right.
And why didn't your bill include, were you discriminating against
right.
Catholics?
Right.
Because you didn't write in parochial
right.
schools. And I said, if the parochial schools want me to, you know, broaden this to include them, I'd be happy to do so. But
right.
that was not really what the message we were getting
right.
early on from those schools. So in the end, this only applies to public schools. And we would hope that other schools would take the model of what these schools are doing. And if you go on the SED website, there's a whole bunch of information about bullying and curriculum, and you can find it all there on the State Education Department website.
And can you? What is that website for?
I would have no idea.
Oh, okay. So they'll just Google the New York State Education
Department
website.
State Department of Education, you'll get it, yeah.
In fact, I think you have it right on your, let me just see if I have it here, website, www.p12.com. NYSED.gov/Dignity Act.
There you go.
But I'm sure if you just Google Dignity Act, New York State, you'll get there. So Assemblyman O'Donnell, what are your thoughts and what are the chances that we'll ever be able to get some type of anti-bullying legislation into our workplace anti-discrimination laws?
Well, it's interesting because there was a very big case called the East Meadow, where the courts ruled that the state human rights laws don't apply to schools. So one of the bills that I have would change that, would make the human rights law be inclusive into the schools, which they currently are not. Additionally, there was a recent case out of the Southern District, Wang versus Phoenix Satellite Television, which ruled that that New York State human rights law does not apply to unpaid interns.
Mm-hmm.
And so a woman there was being sexually harassed, and she had no remedy to go to state court to say, I'm being sexually harassed. My bill, 8201, would fix that, would clarify that. In fact, those rules that apply in the workplace for paid employees also apply for unpaid interns. You know, we
right.
in our society, this was not true, Jack, when you and I were younger, you know, almost everybody I know gets out of college and gets an unpaid internship.
That's right.
For a year. That's the mechanism to learn and to get an access to the job market. So
right.
the idea that all of these people who are in this job market but are not technically an employee are not covered by our human rights law are certainly things that we need to address. The problem with dignity as applying, well, first of all, we'd like to expand dignity to include colleges, right? So
mm-hmm.
that would be the first expansion beyond what we are. In the workplace, it's a little bit more difficult because a lot of what dignity does, requires reporting to state ed
mm-hmm.
about what is happening in the schools.
Right.
And so to do a dignity kind of thing for the workplace would require a whole new reporting structure about what is happening in all the employers in the state of New York. Obviously, when we pass many laws, we exempt a whole class of employees, people with less than 50 employees. For example, when I first arrived, I had a constituent who came to me and was really mad because she ran a company, and as she put it, her best employee was gay, and he had a domestic partner, and she wanted to give his domestic partner insurance on her insurance plan, but the law that we wrote that allowed that only covered employees with 50 or more.
Mm-hmm.
And so she was like, why can't I give a benefit to this employee that my competitor can give? And so in the end, I don't know whether or not, if you were to write that, you would create a reporting requirement for a lot of levels of employers that currently don't report that kind of information. But they do have... The paid ones do have recourse in the Human Rights Commission, so we're hoping that that's where that information would go.
The New York City Human Rights Commission?
New York State.
The New York State, I'm sorry, the Division of Human Rights?
Yes,
okay.
Yes, sorry.
And if in the, is your bill, does it sort of then turn schools into, in essence, a public accommodation? Is that, because What is the mechanism? Students under your bill, students are then covered under the executive law, the New York State Human Rights Law, would be covered on the what was the protected class? I'm trying to understand what the bill then says for the state. You're just amending the state's human rights law then to say that based on race, color, gender identity, or sexual orientation in the schools now, it would be any type of, you know, adverse or hostile work environment?
Well, no, the bill that I was referring to would amend the executive law to expand the protections, civil rights protections, to people who are unpaid.
The intern. I'm sorry.
Right,
I was conflating. I thought you had said.
Yeah, no. So, you know, that bill, to me, says a very important thing, because obviously we want to create workplaces that are safe for people to work in and free from that environment mm-hmm. of harassment. And so, in the end, this distinction that the courts said was in the law, which was if you're not paid, you don't qualify, to me, was wrong-headed and needs to be fixed.
Well, it's certainly wrong-headed because not only are these people in the workplace, but they're usually the youngest, most vulnerable of the employees that are easiest to abuse, generally speaking, right? They're unpaid. They have no protection. Certainly, if one, you know, in terms of both sexual harassment or any other kind of, you know, economic abuse that you could heap on an intern, that's why they deserve as much protection, if not more so, you know, than someone who is a so-called full-time, full employee. So that's an excellent bill. Is that pending still?
Yes, it's pending in our House. It passed through the first committee. It's now in the Codes Committee, and I hope that it will be voted on before the end of the year.
And how is, I was just asking, Deborah, and forgive my ignorance, and you could explain this to us, is there, you know, in terms of the breakdown in the New York State legislature, perhaps Republicans to Democrats, and in terms of the ability to pass legislation that perhaps like-minded progressives would like passed? How challenging is it?
Well, it's not for the weak of heart, Jack. I can tell you that.
Okay.
You know, we have let me just say this. One of the frustrations is certainly when you come from the city of New York and you deal with people who operate in the city of New York, we often think a lot alike, right?
Right,
so there are no real Republicans in New York City, really. Okay? And, you know, if you look at the national Republicans, you understand why we don't have them here, right?
Right.
So the city council can do whatever it wants.
Right.
The city council. Well, here, you know, we have a bicameral system, so we have two houses.
Right.
We, in the lower house, the assembly, we control the house. We have 100 votes out of 150.
Okay.
So we can pretty much pass whatever we want to pass.
Right.
Then the question is, how do we get the Senate to go on board? Now, the truth is that in the last election cycle, the Democrats took back control of the Senate,
mm-hmm.
And yet a bunch of Democrats joined the Republican side and, you know, kept the Republicans in control. Now, we, in our House, passed the Women's Equality Agenda, which is a 10-point thing that included everything and, most importantly, included the ability of a woman to control her own body.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't really think there is equality without the right to control your own body.
Mm-hmm.
But the Republicans in the Senate and the Democrats on their side refused to vote for that Women's Equality Agenda because it included a statement that women have a right to choose. It doesn't go further than Roe v. Wade does,
mm-hmm.
but it just made Roe v. Wade the law of state of New York. So obviously, if we were to get a state Senate that was actually Democratic and the Democrats controlled, you know, we would have a much better chance at getting progressive legislation passed. I've recently been appointed chair of the Corrections Committee, so I now have oversight of all the prisons. Mm-hmm. I've been to 12 of them in the last year, and so there's a lot of good progressive legislation that can be done to improve the quality and the conditions in the prisons, but you need a partner in the Senate to get some of that stuff done. So it's an interesting dance, shall we say.
I mean, do they, just in terms of whether it's filibustering issues or supermajority, and you talk about these Democrats, I guess, you know, the conservative or the blue dog type Democrats that we have here that are joining them, I mean, does it turn out that there's a critical mass that those Democrats that join with the Republicans, you still have, your work is cut out for you because the Senate is still largely, use this term, you know, sort of advisedly, conservative? That it's that really nothing gets through, that doesn't have, you know, that it's not sort of diluted into, it's very difficult to get anything through that you've already passed in the Assembly through this particular Senate as it now stands?
It's more difficult than it should be. We don't have filibuster here, but we don't let bills on the floor that the majority party who runs the House doesn't want. Now, the good side of that is, when we had when the death penalty was struck down and the Republicans wanted us to pass a reinstatement of the death penalty, it was me and other Assembly Democrats who stood firm and said, no, we won't. And so that's why we no longer have the death penalty in New York, because we refused to take that up. The Republicans can do that, too. And oftentimes, it's the art of compromise. I mean, you know, many of my constituents were unhappy with components in the state budget. It was a $140 billion budget. You can't vote no on a $140 billion budget because you don't like one line. You can't do that. You know, when you're in the majority, as I am, you participate in negotiations and the strategy, and you say what your priorities are, and these are the things that are important. Are you going to get with everything you want? Well, no. This is a three-legged stool. The governor has to agree, the Senate has to agree, and we have to agree. And so they put in things that I don't really care for, and we put in things that they don't really care for, and that's what you try to do. And when it comes to legislation, you know, if there's a way to get something you want, you know, like, for example, people want reform of the parole rules, and somebody wrote a very good bill, the Safe Parole Act, but the Safe Parole Act will never pass the state Senate. Never.
Right. Why?
Because it's too broad. It's just over. It's just a huge, it's a seismic shift. So do you go by trying to cut off a little bit around the edges, get little advances, or do you try to go for the seismic shift? If you have enough votes for a seismic shift, go for it. But
well, I just
we don't.
Well, but when I heard you speak about the shock program and saying, you know, on the floor and saying that you were all in favor of your former public defender, as was I, and that you know, it was a great program, but you don't have the bodies, you don't have the people for it now, and that that you'd be happy if your friends on the other side of the aisle would join you. That you'd be happy to do whatever it needed to be done. I don't recall the particulars of it, but you were still sort of lobbying for, you know, to someone to join you in a program that will reduce incarceration, will reduce the amount, the funds. Do you tell our listeners, what does it cost to keep someone incarcerated, a nonviolent person in New York State for a year?
About $60,000.
$60,000. How many inmates do we currently have?
$55,000. 55,000 inmates.
55,000 inmates, which is a new is a record or no? Is it
no,
now?
It's on its way down, it's which is one of the frustrations about, which is why they've closed prisons, but we see, keep on closing prisons, but the number of prison guards are going up. So I don't know exactly what you do about that. But, yes, I mean, I just today, Jack, signed, introduced a bill that would broaden who's eligible for shock. And I look forward to bringing it to my Republican colleagues who seem so interested in keeping their prisons open to see whether or not they're going to help me.
So,
because if you get more people into the shock facilities...
Okay, can you just explain shock
I'm sorry, I'm
for
sorry.
Me?
So, yes. So shock incarceration is a program where it's sort of run like Marine boot camp. And you go in and you get a sentence, let's say, of 2 to 6, okay? And rather than having to do 6... you do 8 months to a year of shock, where you are treated like boot camp. You get up at 6 a.m., you go for a 5 mile. I don't even know what happens. But you're programmed 24-7 in a way that you're not programmed when you go to a regular prison. And if you complete that 8-month program, you go home. So because we got rid of the Rockefeller drug laws, thank God, there are fewer and fewer people who are eligible to go into the shock program based on the current rules. So today I put in a bill that would expand who is eligible to get into the shock program in the hopes that more people who are eligible can get in and therefore they don't spend as many years in prison.
And if there's opposition from those in the Senate for this, it's again probably a dollars and cents issue about their prisons and their towns and their guards, and sort of, or is it just sort of a come under the rubric of what's a law and order type? You know, we don't want to be compassionate. They should just serve their time, no parole, no conditional release, no shock.
It's mostly the second one, although even the ones who say that now understand that if they want to keep their prisons open and they want, you know, Monterey Shock to be, you know, kept open or reopened, you need to put more people in it and or make people eligible for it. Nobody's... It doesn't require anybody. It only allows docs to choose people, a broader group of people to choose from. And so in the end, there are a lot of ways we can make this better. You know, another bill I may put in is allow a judge to to sentence someone to shock. Judicial discretion so that, mm-hmm. that they can, from the beginning, get that. But in the end, as you know, Jack, shock was a very good program when it first came on. I was at legal aid at the time, and it really, really worked, and it helped.
Our clients crowed about it, and their families did. First of all, besides getting out earlier, a lot of them did say, you know what, we needed a little bit of this sort of, that sort of discipline, the whole notion, discipline, honor, self-regard, exercise, perhaps, just learning something that they never learned. So, in terms of how to take care of yourself, how to work in a team spirit, all of that.
Right. And,
but isn't part of the whole prison issue based on the privatization of all of the prisons and how people, just the United States alone has so many prisoners in comparison to the rest of the world?
That is absolutely true, but we have no private prisons in the state of New York, and we will not.
Right. So, okay, so... do you mind speaking a little bit, just because it's such, to talk about your experience getting the Marriage Equality Act passed, because it was a day I remember, when it finally happened. It was like, it's about freaking time. This is New York, right? And I know you were, the lead, the person who I probably catalyzed this more than anyone else. And I also know when you married your partner of many decades. I believe it was well attended, including by the governor, and it was quite a poignant and touching tribute to the work that you've done. And I know many of our colleagues and friends that now have this equality in New York, owe you and many others, a debt of gratitude. I just wonder if you could tell us a little bit about what that took and how that went about in terms of the when you reached that critical mass and you knew it was about to happen. And what it took for you personally and how it felt to get to that point.
Well, thank you for that introduction about it. Yes, my husband and I have been together for 33 years, which is a very long time. Mm-hmm. And when I got elected, a friend of mine, Robbie Kaplan, the best lawyer I know from Paul Weiss, called me and said, I want you to be the plaintiff in this marriage lawsuit. And I said, no, I'm not the right person. We had a long conversation. Eventually she said, no, you should. So John and I became one of the groups of plaintiffs in the marriage lawsuit that went to the Court of Appeals. Judge Kaye wrote a brilliant dissent that it was right on the money about what this was. But unfortunately, the majority of the court said, no, you have to go to the legislature. So, I'm like, all right, well, that's where I am. So let's start there. Mm-hmm. So the Governor Spitzer sent a program bill. So what happens is if the governor wants a bill of their own, they send it to us. They send it to the legislature, and it's called a program bill. So the governor sent a program bill that called for change the marriage laws, and I became the sponsor. And, it was an interesting 4 years of my life. No one thought we could do it. No one on the governor's staff thought we could do it the first year. And please remember, it's a little different time now. In 2007, when we first passed the bill in the Assembly, there were only 40% of New Yorkers were in favor, so it's not like it is now.
Right.
It was really a very different timing. And a couple of things. One of the things that I learned was how important spouses are in this, because, not to be critical, but neither Deborah Glick, my colleague in the Assembly, nor Tom Duane, who was the openly gay state senator at the time, they didn't bring their partners around. And I knew that if I wanted my colleagues to see my relationship as equal to theirs, that I was going to have to expose that relationship to them. And so John was here every single time we took a vote, some days for 3 or 4 days at a time. And the first time we took a vote, it was pretty funny because we had 6 undecided votes, and they wouldn't tell me how they were voting, and John was there, and I sent John over to talk to every one of them. One of my colleagues said to me, "You're not sending him over." I'm like, "Oh, he's coming. He's coming to say hello." It helps. He's tall, thin, and handsome, and everyone likes him, and it's, it's good. We're a good yin-yang in that sense, right? But it was very – I only realized after it was done how emotionally draining it was. I went to the governor's mansion the following year for the opening reception, and I said to him, Governor, for the last 5 years, my life has been counting votes. Right. And so all I did was count votes. And you know, and try and make sure that I could keep my coalition together. Now, the last year when it was passed, we only had 77 votes. You need 76 to pass it. A bunch of my colleagues have retired, and some had lost elections, and blah, blah, blah. And it was, you know, that's a little nerve-wracking when you only have a one-vote margin,
yeah,
right? So I knew I had always had work to do. What I'll say is that it takes strategy, and there are some great thinkers in our community. And, you know, when I first passed it, every year, every week, I came to Albany with a color-coded chart to give to the leadership to say this is where the vote count is, and I would send a letter. And it would be a poll. There was a brilliant, wonderful letter written by Mildred Loving, who was the woman in Loving v. Virginia, an African-American, Cherokee-American woman who married a white man and was arrested, and that's what threw out the anti-miscegenation law.
Right.
And she wrote a letter saying this is the same issue. So she gave that to me, and I was like, all right. And so I said, here's a letter that I think you might find interesting. The other part of that was every single one of those communications from my colleagues, I signed myself and ended with, John and I thank you for taking the time to consider voting for me.
Right, that's beautiful.
Made it very personal to them. So people felt like, I can't vote against Danny, is what they sort of got. But that's really
that's
what sometimes you're required to do.
Right.
And what, when Governor Cuomo became governor and he was working on the Senate to help get those votes, you know, it was quite an intense environment here. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I thought when they voted yes the first time would be the highlight. But when I was in the state Senate chamber and the lieutenant governor said, do we have a message from the assembly? And they said, yes, we have Mr. O'Donnell's bill. He said, take up Mr. O'Donnell's bill. Let me tell you, that was a heady moment. You're standing here, in, you know, on the arc of history,
right?
And it's my name. So how did that happen?
Exactly.
You know? And it's funny. I met I had never met the president until last year, and it was just the day before he changed his mind about marriage. And I walked up to him. I said, and I was invited. I didn't even know I was going to meet him, but I went to this place and I was getting a photo. And he said to me, I said, let me tell you. I said, Mr. President, I'm the man who passed the gay marriage bill here in New York. And he literally looked like a deer caught in the headlights. Like, what is this man going to say to me next? And I said, and because of that, I said, I got married last January, and I want to assure you of one thing. And he said, what's that? I said, not a single heterosexual was harmed during my wedding. So the pictures
of
me and a hysterical Barack Obama. So I said to him, and since January 29th, I said, not one bad thing has happened to one straight person in the entire United States of America, because I moved a ring from my right hand to my left.
Oh, my God.
I said, I'd like you to keep that in the forefront of your mind as you continue to evolve. So he's like, you know, still laughing, right? So I said to him, I said, well, I'll see you on Monday. He said, what? I said, Mr. President, I said, aren't you speaking at Barnard on Monday? He's like, well, yes. I said, well, I live in New York where you used to live. And so I'm a guest at Barnard's commencement. He said, well, I lived at 110th in Amsterdam. I said, well, I live at 111th in Broadway. He said, well, you know, it's a much nicer neighborhood now. And I said, that, Mr. President, is because it's well represented. And off I go, right? So now I get this phone, you know, so I get this frantic phone call. Everyone's telling me he's about to go on and say that he changed his mind. So my friend from the White House, who had arranged for me to meet him, called me, and I said, look, you know, I'm not telling the press about my conversation. I said, but if you think he's going on TV today and changing his mind and I'm not telling this story, you're wrong. And so I'm like, no, you can tell the story. So, you know, it no harm comes to anyone. You know, it's, as I've always pointed out to people, this is not, you know, this is not Roman Catholic, you know, sacrament. This is not the sacrament of holy matrimony. I'm not eligible for the sacrament of holy matrimony. I'm okay with that.
Right.
That's not what this is.
It's a
civil marriage license that is given out by the state. And we were very lucky. Judge Kay married us. We had 450 people at our wedding.
That
was not because we're egomaniacs, but because I promised all my colleagues, if they voted yes, that they'd be invited to my wedding. Then after we passed it, I said to John, I said, what are we going to tell them? Now I don't like you. Like, you know, and they all showed up.
Right.
But this was the best part, Jack, to have a wedding like that where 200 or 250 gay people get to go to the people who made it happen and thank them.
Right.
That was pretty priceless.
That is one moving tale. So, so President Obama changed his mind a day later?
Correct. Goes on nationwide TV the next day.
Oh, my Lord. Okay. So, that yes, that's a story you must keep telling.
Yeah. And the picture, I have a picture of my New York City office at my Albany office of a hysterical laughing Barack Obama and me.
That is precious. You know, isn't it just that one of the things I, you know, when you said, when you humanized yourself the way you did, you and John, thank you, John, and the way you do, because I give you so much credit, because I, see, I have a problem personally. I'm one of these people who say, I don't know that I know any Republicans, Daniel. You know, it's one of those things. I just have a hard time with, you know, being able to have these, discuss these issues when I say, well, but you're coming from a place, for instance, if you were dealing in the legislature with what you perceive to be just homophobia, what you perceive to be, you know, intractable bias and, you know, inflexibility and something that might make us angry, at least in the old days, right? And the fact that you come from it in a place that was this inclusivity and saying, you know what, it's you, you're my colleagues, I want you to see me as a person, and you modeled it. I mean, I guess that's what it is. You modeled it so that it became, hey, it's Danny. Maybe if it wasn't, you're the spokesmodel, so hey, Danny can get married, you know, we'll let him get married, and we might as well, we, you know, let everybody get married, because Danny sold us on it, Danny and John. If there's this humanistic part of it, and I guess that's part of the holism.
Well, that's part of what this job is. Mm-hmm. And one of my colleagues said to me, what is the last thing you do at night when you're in Albany? I said, I called John and said goodnight. He said, then you already are married.
Right.
I said, well, then why can't I get a piece of paper? He's like, I don't know. Right. Put me on the bill. I'm like, all right, there you go. Another one down. But it was a great victory, and I feel really, really blessed to be able to have performed a role in the arc of history. And I do believe that when New York passed it, it became the tipping point in the entire conversation.
I think so. You're absolutely right. And, you know, this long arc of history bending towards justice, it started bending. You know, you could see the bend leftward at this point in time with you and these issues, which is just, again, something that you'll take to your grave. I mean, that's just such a beautiful, it's just, it's so beautiful. Mm. Speaking of equality, I wonder if I could just ask you, and for our listeners that are interested in the New York Women's Equality Agenda, what is, you know, can you just tell us a little bit about it and what people can do, and can they call their Congress folk, and what are the chances that it will pass? Because I think this is an important, this doesn't get very much coverage in our local corporate media.
I would love to. You know, the governor proposed the Women's Equality Agenda, which would be a 10-point provision that involves a variety of things that almost everyone agrees about. You know, pay equity is part of it, and access. I mean, all the things that you talked about before, about the nature of women in the workforce and what their lives are like, this would begin to correct that. And the most important one of them, in my opinion, is the right to choose. Because if you can't control your own body, then you have no rights. And, you know, when I've been invited to speak at a variety of places around that issue, I talk about it in the same way that it's the same issue as the gay rights agenda. The ability to control your own body. What straight people do with their bodies is one thing, and when I did it, it was illegal. Mm-hmm. And so in the end, it's the same issue. Do you have control over your own body? And the Senate refuses to take it up because it includes the woman's right to choose. And so get on your phone, get on your email, tell your state senator, I want all 10 points of the Women's Equality Agenda passed.
And in terms of these numbers, you know, I know it's a little bit easier, I think, nationally. Can people find their state senator online?
Oh, it's very simple. If you go to the League of Women Voters website, you can just type your address in, and they'll tell you who represents you.
Terrific. And then there's a phone number and an email address for
their person.
Yes, okay.
There is. And we don't need any help in the assembly. We just need help in the Senate.
Very good. And when is the next time that potentially will come up for a vote?
Anytime between now and the end of June.
Between now and the end of June. And then if it doesn't, but right now it's looking precarious, as I said at the beginning of the hour.
I believe it is, and that depresses me a great deal. But if enough pressure is put on their senators, they can make that happen. I mean, you know, one of the great ironies in the marriage thing was when you looked at the polling data, even higher than my district, Long Island, the voters were 70% in favor of it, and yet most of their senators vote no. How is it that most of Long Island is favorable of a woman's right to choose, and yet their senators are blocking the women's equality agenda. They could do something about that, getting on those phones and getting to that email.
And unlike, then again, on the national level, this is not simply a, this isn't a Chamber of Commerce issue, I take it then, right? I mean, I'm trying to understand then the underlying, if it's not a who owns these particular senators, you know, who's sort of pulling their strings, is this just under, again, the sort of the auspices of, you know, it's back to, you know, a religious objection? Is it back to they are pro-life and that's why we won't vote for this so-called pro-life? Is that what it comes down to?
No, some of them aren't even pro-life, but they won't vote for it because they're afraid of the Conservative Party.
Right.
Conservative Party has said if you voted for marriage, you know, Senator Flanagan from Comac, where I grew up, 70% of his voters were in favor of marriage equality. He voted no. Why? Because Mike Long, the Conservative Party, said if you vote for that, we will never endorse you again.
Okay.
And so that's the game that's played. But the truth is, those folks should be reminded what their voters actually think.
Well,
and on this subject, they're with me and not with them.
Right. Well, what their voters actually think, and of course, what Jesus Christ would have actually thought. I mean, you know, when you sort of come down to, again, you know, the old, what Jesus Christ, of course, was a liberal, what would he do? And we're just talking about, it's always under the, again, the concept of this is, that's why he's saying back to what your father so-and-so wouldn't, we're not in favor of same-sex marriage, and we're not in favor of anything that seems to be sort of anti, if it's sort of anti biblical, right? Because there's no one, it still comes down to individual people when questioned, you know, way more often than not, will vote for fairness and equality and the right to control one's own autonomous, you know, person and body.
Well, won't during they? The marriage debate, one of my colleagues kept a reading from the Torah, and I didn't have the heart to tell him that my family didn't read that book. Okay? Like, I'm not against the book, but we didn't read that one. So, but, you know, everyone has the right to their own religion and their own religious beliefs, but that ends at imposing them on somebody
exactly.
else.
Exactly. Well, beautifully said. Assemblyman Daniel O'Donnell, we have 1 minute left, so I will take this time to thank you very much for being with us today. Perhaps we can have you back when one of your bills, you know, passes again, so we can celebrate it. And is there anything? What is your website?
You can just contact me through the Assembly website.
Through the Assembly website. Terrific.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
I would like to come back again, and Jack, I recognize that voice anywhere.
Thank you very much, Dan. It was great talking with you. Thanks for all the great work you do.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome. Bye-bye now. Well, that was a pleasure. I hope that was informative to our listeners and our viewers. And we will be wrapping it up until next week, and we will tell you during the week who our guest will be, as we had someone who can no longer be with us, so we're not sure. Until then, have an outstanding week. Stay strong. Don't quit. If you're working for an employer and they're giving you a hard time, just remember, don't quit. Quit is a four-letter word to us civil rights lawyers. Never do it. And if you have any challenges in your work environment and you wish to contact us, Jack Tuckner, Deborah O'Rell, Tuckner, Sipser, Weinstock, and Sipser, call us at 212-766-9100 or visit us on our website at www.womensrightsny.com. And remember, do not give up and don't you dare give in. Jack Tuckner, Deborah O'Rell, signing out.